This is the After Hours Director Spotlight, presented by Amro Music. It's the podcast where we chat with music educators to celebrate the joy of teaching music and learn about strategies for success. In this episode, Nick Averwater talks with Randall Standridge. Randall is best known as a highly respected composer and arranger, but he was also a band director for many years. We'll learn about his early career working in a rural public school district, his techniques for teaching students how to practice the right way, and more. Our conversation is broken up into two episodes, and this is part one.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to After Hours Director Spotlight, where we sit down with some of the top educators we can find and just hear about their story, their lessons, and what brought them to where they are today. And today I have the privilege of sitting down with Randall Standridge. Now, I suspect many of you are familiar with Randall and his pieces as a composer, and we're going to talk a lot about that, what it's like to be on the other side of the pen composing the music. But we also are going to hear about Randall's career as an educator, where he started and what led him to being a composer, and just a wonderful person that I'm very excited to welcome on After Hours. So, Randall, welcome. Good to see you.
Thank you for having me.
Again, a lot of people know, I mean, you travel the country, you do all sorts of clinics, clinicking bands and doing workshops, but a lot of people may not know that you started a career as an educator. So why don't you take us through those early stages? What led you to become an educator and then transition into the world of arranging and composing?
Okay, well, just to give you a little bit of my background, my first degree, which I got from Arkansas State University, was music education, bachelor's in music education. And upon graduating, I got what would end up being the only job I ever had, which was at Harrisburg, Arkansas. And I was there for 12 years, and it was a very interesting situation for a lot of reasons. Number one, it's a small, very small rural school just on the outskirts of Jonesboro. So we're talking about a town population of around 2,000, class size, year class size is about 60 to 70, so very small. And because of this, I was the only band director for many years. Not all of the years, but for many of them, I taught by myself, which means, for example, I taught the fifth grade, recorder band, the sixth grade beginning band, the seventh and eighth middle school band, and the 9th or 12th high school band, along with anything else I chose to teach, such as after school jazz band or anything else like that. So, I mean, that was all me. And it really forced me into a situation where I had to get comfortable, kind of wearing a lot of hats at all levels. Because the way you're going to teach and approach a high school ensemble, of course, is very different than you're going to teach beginners or even fifth graders. So I had to get very good at it's just switching between those modes, but also finding the common elements between them. And that's one thing that I will say I think was very good about the situation for me is I think people who get stuck into just being a middle school teacher or just being a high school teacher might lose, a little bit of the commonality between all of the modes. And so that was something that was really good. But anyway, I was there for 12 years. The last four of those years, I was very lucky to have an assistant. They finally did hire me assistant, which just so happened to be my husband, Steve Kazort. And so we taught together there for 4 years, and it was a really fun time. We were able to make the program a lot better. And it was just, I have nothing but fond memories of teaching there. So that was pretty much it. Now, as far as transitioning into being a composer, I've been composing ever since I was about 10 years old. Now, I don't want to give, the listeners the wrong impression. I was definitely not a wunderkind, Mozart type. Like, I wasn't writing symphonies or, large pieces or anything like that. But it was more akin to what I would call doodling. I would write a little melody here, a little rhythmic fragment there, and I would kind of play around with it. But as with any hobby like that, it grows. Like, you get more adept at it, you build some skills, and you just get better. So I was doing this all through high school and even through college. And while I was studying music education for my undergraduate, I also studied composition with Dr. Tom O'Connor. And so I was just kind of building up these skills and eventually got into arranging for marching band. Of course, I wrote a lot for my own. People liked what I was doing, so I ended up writing for quite a few others. And then I started publishing works with Grand Mesa Music, which eventually led to other opportunities publishing with Alfred, FJH, and Winger Jones. And it just kind of exploded from there. So the transition from being an educator to a composer, it really, to be honest, came about by necessity. Because there did come a point towards the end of my teaching career where I would just flatly say that my life was completely out of balance. Because, you know, band directing and music education, when we say it's a full-time job, you know, we mean that in the truest sense of the words, because you're teaching all day, you're doing lessons, you're doing parent meetings, you're doing performances, there's all the plan. It's really intense. But so is being a really successful composer, because you've got to do the writing, which of course is the majority of the time. But then, you know, if you're going to be successful, you also have to do the business side. You have to go out, get your music out, you have to make contacts, return emails. And that may not sound like a lot, but it is a lot. And so doing both of those things at the same time, there came a point where there was just no time for me, no time for my life, no time for me and Steve, no time for anything but the jobs. And, you know, I just had to kind of take a long, hard look and say, this is not the way I want to live. Because, you know, I'm very much a firm believer that time is the most valuable asset we have. And I just felt like all of my time was being eaten away by my jobs. And so I made the decision to pursue composition for a while, because I was like, you know, I'll do this. And if it doesn't work out, I will go back to teaching and not consider that a bad thing, because I really enjoyed teaching. But it just became impossible to manage both careers at the same time. So made that decision. That was roughly 8 years ago. And things have worked out great. My music seems to have found an audience in the band world, and it's starting to expand into the orchestra world and other places like that. I've been very fortunate to start my own publishing company, which I'm very excited about, Randall Standards Music, which is currently in its second year of existence, just released my first album on iTunes, Spotify, and things like that not long ago either. So, I mean, you know, that's been the kind of journey, and it's all been really great.
That's absolutely fantastic, and I love how organic, because it doesn't sound like you studied composition, but it sounds like more out of a passion. Hey, I enjoy this, rather than, hey, I'm going to have a career in this one day. And it sounds like you just very slowly grew into this. And now I know you've had pieces featured at MEA shows all over the country, including at TMEA, and a lot of bands, large and small, are playing your music, and I've just really enjoyed watching that. I want to reflect a little bit, because you and I did not have the privilege of meeting while you were teaching at Harrisburg. I've only known Randall Standridge, the composer, but I hear so many wonderful things about what you were able to accomplish while you were there teaching in a small band, and the quality of the musicianship that you all did, and the things that you all accomplished was at a very high level. You really grew the program. And I suspect, you know, the reflection of them hiring assistant is a reflection of the success you were having. What do you think are some of the keys to success for these directors who wear all of the hats? Because oftentimes those are young directors too, who are just getting started in their career.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny because, of course, you know, when all of this was going on and when I was running the program, it was very immediate and very visceral, because, you know, you're just in the moment and kind of trying to do the best for your program. Now that I've been away from it for 8 years and had time to reflect on what we did, I think there are some key things that would be good for, you know, new directors and older directors to really think about. The biggest thing for me, like the biggest aha moment, because I'm going to, like, I will say that there, if you really look at my time at Harrisburg, there were like three distinct stages of development of the program. The first 3 years were really me just kind of learning how to be a director. And so while we were successful and we got a lot better, I really don't think I was a great director during that time. I was learning and I was getting better. Each year was better than the one before, but I was definitely, struggling to kind of find my style of teaching. I had an aha moment in my sometime between my fourth and fifth year of teaching, where I realized that I had been approaching my band program from the aspect of, okay, I want to create a great band, and by creating a great band, I'm going to create great players. And so that was kind of how I was approaching everything, because that's how I viewed it. I read a couple of books that I would say really changed like my entire approach to teaching. One was a book that I recommend to everybody. It's called How to Make First Chair by C. Roberts, which is basically just a guide on how to practice. It's really great. And the second one was a book called The Band That Took a Chance. I do not remember the name of the author off the top of my head, but it's about the Ithaca High School band program under the direction of Frank Battisti when he was there. Just both of those, what I came to realize was that what I was doing was exactly backwards. Because what I needed to be doing was focusing on individual players and their individual musicianship, literacy, and excellence. And by that, the byproduct of that would be having a great band. And so I totally flipped the script on what I was doing. I changed pretty much everything about how I was approaching teaching. And it really became about teaching all of the students music literacy, individual achievement, and, you know, and then molding that into an ensemble. But, you know, I wanted the students to be able to be musically successful and musically literate beyond the confines of my classroom. And so that kind of became the goal. And once we did that, that's to me, that's when the program really took off. And I was happier. The students were happier. And we just experienced a lot of success. The second thing I will say to all of that is that we started also just kind of putting the focus on basics, like beyond just the regular musician. I mean, it's amazing to me the things that people will not focus on that, you know, that they should. For instance, tone. I was kind of known as being like the tone, you know, overlord for the band. Because like if a student was not producing a good quality tone, that was a significant problem. And for the younger directors or directors that might not be experiencing a lot of success out there listening, I'll tell you exactly why. You can teach your students to play 16th notes, or they could not play 16th notes, you know, and you could just pick music that doesn't do that. If your students play great in the key of D flat, that's great. If they don't play great in the key of D flat, you can just pick other pieces that are in other keys. But if your students play with bad tone, there is no hiding that. And it is bad from beginning to end. Like if you play a piece, any piece, even an easy piece from beginning to end, and the tone is bad from beginning to end, like as an adjudicator, as an audience member, and even, you know, as a musician, I can't enjoy that. You know, it's really impossible to enjoy bad sound. So we started focusing on tone. We started focusing on tuning. We started focusing on rhythmic accuracy. One of the things I do with clinics when I go out, the first thing I do is I listen to a group warm up, and I will be able to tell everything I'm going to need to fix about that band by how they warm up. Because you'll hear people dropping notes. You'll hear people not hitting things accurately because the students understand how long the notes should be, but they're not focused on achieving it and achieving it 100% accurately. So we really just kind of went back to basics, and, you know, between that and the individual development, we really, like, you know, came alive as a band. And lastly, I just think I made smart decisions about the situations I would put the band in. You know, like we had a really successful marching band, but I would get comments sometimes because my band was really good. People were like, "Well, don't you think you could do a harder show?" And I was like, "Well, yeah, we probably could." I was like, "But I don't want to spend 6 and 7 hours after school a week with my kids. I've got a life outside of, you know, band." So I would do, you know, I would pick music, or write music rather, and design a show that we could clean with 3 hours of rehearsal after school every week and be successful with. Because I wanted to balance the students' experience, but also respect the fact that they also had lives outside of band.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I tried to be smart about the literature I'd pick to where we would push the kids a little bit, grow, be successful, but also not, you know, put ourselves in a situation where we were uncomfortable and stressed all of the time.
Yeah, I think all three of those are wise. I want to dig into the first one a little bit with you, where you talked about transitioning from, you know, the band as an ensemble to the focus on the individual musicianship of the players, and then letting that feed up into the band. Do you remember kind of how your curriculum evolved, how your focus and what you emphasize evolved to help move from the group component to the singular member component, the musicianship teaching style?
Oh, yes, absolutely. So, I mean, just a few of the real practical things we did. It started with me realizing when I read that book, How to Make First Chair, one of the first things I realized was that I was not teaching my students how to practice. I was insisting that they did practice. I was like, you need to practice. And I'd be like, you need to practice this. I would give them assignments, do things like that. But I was not once addressing, like, this is how you practice. Like, this is the art form of practicing. This is the procedure for practicing. So one of the first changes we did was that. And I was very explicit about it. Like, this was not something I tried to sneak in or just trick the kids into knowing this. I mean, when I first introduced it program-wide, we took a good week and just learned how to practice. And then we practiced practicing. And we expanded on that into, it became procedures that we used in class. Anytime I would stop for an etude we were working on or some repertoire we were working on, I would use the procedures that I expected them to use when they were individually practicing as an opportunity to review, as an opportunity to reinforce that. Because one thing I discovered through that experience was a lot of my kids that were resistant to practicing, it was just because, quite frankly, they weren't good at it. And whose fault was that? Mine. I mean, it wasn't the kid. You know, kids don't come into your program knowing how to practice. One thing I get a little bit frustrated with when I go visit programs is I see a lot of directors doing what I would call teaching to their smartest kids. You know, you'll get these kids that are just freakishly smart and freakishly talented and kind of naturally figure out how to practice. And because they've figured it out, the attitude becomes, oh, well, everybody else should have figured it out. That's not necessarily true, because we have lots of different types of learners, lots of learners that are on different levels. And to me, if you really want to judge the success of a band program, you judge it from the middle down. How are you addressing the kids who are in the middle of the ability level and down, and how are you growing them? If you can judge that and say you're being successful there, then you have a successful band program. But if you're only catering to the naturally talented kids, I think you're not so successful. And I'm just going to be very blunt about that.
Yeah. I think that's so smart, too, because, A, I mean, we talk about the benefits of music are so much more than just learning to play an instrument. And the idea of, you know, correctly practicing is something we can apply in all sorts of our lives. But you're right. I mean, I think back to some of my time in particularly middle school band, and I think, you know, practicing, quote unquote, was just a little practice log. And you just wrote, if you know, you check the box, okay, I practiced my 10 or 15 or 20. I can't remember how long it was. But what did, you know, efficient practice. So what did you teach the students? Because I have to imagine it was more than just moments that you check a box on a page.
Oh, yeah. No, these were like procedures. Like we taught them techniques to practice.
Yeah. Do you remember those?
Well, the first thing we had to address really was music literacy. Because if students do not have high music literacy, to be quite blunt, they can't practice on their own. Because, I mean, if you're not there to tell them what to do and they have no idea how to interpret the music, it's just kind of wasted time. So, you know, once we started introducing the practice thing, I started addressing music literacy pretty hardcore. My first step was we really dug into the chromatic scale. Because I was like, bare minimum, the students need to know every single note on their instrument from memory. This does not need to be a question. And so we like really dug into that as a band program from beginner all the way through high school. And the students would have tests every few weeks to just prove that they knew the names of the notes, sharps going up, flats going down, and all of the positions. I didn't expect them to do it quickly. I did not, you know, it wasn't a race. There was no tempo that they had to achieve. Just bare minimum, you need to be able to do this up and down, full range of your instrument. So we addressed that. Second thing is I started including little reminders into my daily warm-up with the kids of just basic music literacy. It was nothing, you know, that we took a long time with. It was just things like, this is a clef. This is what a clef does. Here is how it puts the notes on the staff. So, it, you know, and then here's what a sharp does. Here, you know, things like that. So we started addressing things like that. And just kind of incorporating more literacy moments into our program so that the students could be successful in practicing. So that was step one. Some of the techniques, we taught them to slow down with practicing. We taught them, you know, instead of just trying to run through the whole thing as fast as they could, you know, step one, look at the music. You know, what is the key signature? What is this? I mean, I know this all sounds basic, but a lot of students don't know to just stop and do this. And so we made it official. It's like, this is the first thing you do. And, you know, second thing, go through, is there a note that you don't understand? Is there a rhythm that you don't understand? If so, mark it and ask us about it tomorrow. You know, and that way we can help you. You know, third thing, go through the piece very slowly without playing. Make sure, you know, go through in the order with the positions of the piece. And then, you know, next thing, you know, play the rhythms on a single pitch. Get comfortable with the rhythms. You know, last thing, start playing the piece slowly. Get it right. Another big thing with this is we taught the kids that music performance, now not like understanding music or the artistry of music, but music performance is primarily physical. It is not mental. This is a really important thing for directors and private instructors to understand, because the way our muscles learn is so different from the way the cognitive part of our brain learns. Our muscles only learn through repetition. That is the only way they can learn. Unfortunately, and I'm sure a lot of directors and students and musicians have seen this, if you practice something incorrectly multiple times, you're still learning. Like, you don't
just
stop
the wrong
learning.
Thing.
You're just learning to do it wrong. So, you know, having the students kind of slow down and learn to expect to have to play something multiple times correctly to build up muscle memory, I think that took a lot of the stress out of their practice, because, you know, I can't even count the number of times I've heard directors, you know, do something once and then say, we shouldn't have to be doing this again. And I'm just like, buddy, you are wrong. You should be having to do it multiple times. Because that's how we build up the muscle memory necessary for really highly excellent performance. I mean, period. That's it.
That's composer, arranger, and educator Randall Standridge talking with Nick Aberwater. This conversation will continue in the next episode of the After Hours Director Spotlight, which is presented by AMRO Music, a family-owned company since 1921. At AMRO, we work with over 600 schools in 7 states to bring the joy of music to thousands of young musicians. And these partnerships make production of the After Hours podcast possible. Our Director Services Department is ready to work with your school, too. Just email alan@amromusic.com or seth@amromusic.com. The After Hours podcast is produced by Nick Aberwater, Emily McGee, and Joel Hurd in Memphis, Tennessee. You can hear many more conversations with music educators at amromusic.com/afterhours.
Hey, if you enjoyed today's episode, here are 2 easy and fast ways you can support the After Hours show. First, your 5-star review means a lot, as it helps to boost us in the podcast rankings so that other music educators just like you can find us. Second, if you thought of someone that would enjoy this week's content and episode, hey, please share it with them so that they too can be a part of the After Hours community. Thanks so much, and we'll see you next week.